Good evening, and welcome to tonight's lecture. Our speaker this evening is Dr. Daniel Jeremy Silver, Senior Rabbi of the Temple. Rabbi Silver has served as President of the Cleveland Board of Rabbis and was Chairman of the Israel Task Force of the Jewish Community Federation for a number of years. He has written many scholarly articles and co-authored recently the two-volume work, A History of Judaism. This evening, Rabbi Silver will conclude our series, or at least our coping series, with adulthood by speaking on the topic, Coping with Our Convictions. Rabbi Silver.
When I was first assigned the topic, Coping with Convictions, I began to wonder if I was a prison warden. But we're free, and what I'd like to do tonight is talk to you about how convictions are formed, the relationship of convictions and our adult personalities, and then to make a few comments on some of the problems that convictions pose for adults. Why, really, the fact that we have convictions is a problem. And perhaps the best way to begin is to refer briefly to the book, The Seasons of a Man's Life, which Dr. Daniel Levison published this year. It's the basic research on which Gail Sheehy battened herself down to produce her book, Passages. Dr. Levison is professor of psychiatry at the Yale Medical School, and he has done some research on men, which leads him to believe that in all of our lives, there are what he calls age-linked phases through which we must all pass. These phases, he believes, have basic consequences for our behavior, for our emotions. Now, he did this study on only 40 men, he and his research team. These 40 men are all about my age. They were chosen for reasons which I do not quite comprehend from four basic occupational categories: workers, business executives, biology professors, and novelists. And I think you'll agree with me that those four professions do not exhaust the realm of human activity. The work is a beginning, initial stage by those who study human nature, the attempt to understand adultness, why we are what we are, why we tend to react the way that we do react. Now, Dr. Levison is very conscious of the fact that he has chosen arbitrarily a certain age group, a certain sex, that there are possibilities that women will show quite different age-linked phases than men, that it is possible that these age-linked phases are peculiar to our American middle-class environment. They will not show up in other cultures, more primitive cultures, other cultures in other parts of the world. But whatever else this research will prove to be or not to be, it's been seminal. And it has made all of us conscious of the fact that adulthood is a very special stage of life with special characteristics, a stage of life which can be studied the same way, developmentally, the same way we study childhood or adolescence or aging. Now, I've always been intrigued by the fact that so much of what we do is, in a sense, conditioned for us, predetermined for us by the language which we master. And I suspect that it's not out of the ordinary, that since English is the only Western language, at least, which has a word, adulthood, which defines this very special stage in human life, that perhaps these researchers are first coming out from American universities. Most languages are like the French, maturité, or German, mundigkeit, languages in which the word for adultness is really the word for ripeness, fullness, and which applies to any living being, animal, perhaps even vegetable. We have a word, adulthood, or adultness. We are conscious that sometime after adolescence, after the teens, early 20s, we emerge into a certain pattern of behavior as well as to a certain physical size and emotional construct, and that we retain or seem to retain much of this construct, much of this size until we pass into aging. Now, one of the questions which Dr. Levinson only alludes to is the question which I've suggested, whether or not these age-linked phases are apparent in other cultures, whether they're universal. Obviously, there's no research. He tends to think that they are. And he brought together in the concluding chapter of his book, and it's with this that I really want to begin, three paragraphs from ancient authors, in which each of them defines from a different culture's point of view the stages in the life of men. And I hope you ladies will forgive me. I'm not a male chauvinist, but almost all ancient literature relates to men and the stages in the life of a man, and this is all really we have to go on. The first of these was written or is ascribed to Solon. Solon was the legendary lawgiver of Athens in the 7th century before the Common Era. And Solon divided the ages of man into 7-year cycles. 7 was a sacred number. And the whole paragraph reads this way. From 0, from birth to 7, a boy at first is the man, unripe. Then he casts his teeth, which he sheds in his 7th year. From 7 to 14, then to his 7 years, God adding another 7, signs of approaching manhood show in the bud. From 14 to 21, still in the 3rd of the 7s, his limbs are growing, his chin touched with a fleecy down, the bloom of the cheek gone. 21 to 28, now in the 4th of the 7s, ripens to greatest completeness the powers of a man, and his worth becomes plain to see. From 28 to 35, in the 5th 7, he bethinks him that this is the season for courting, bethinks him that sons will preserve and continue his line. And then he brings together 2 7s, 14 years, from 35 to 42, the center of adulthood. Now in the 6th, his mind, ever open to virtue, broadens and never inspires him to profitless deeds. From 42 to 56, 7 times 7 and 8, the tongue and the mind for 14 years together are now at their best. 56 to 63, still in the 9th of the 7s, he is able, but never so nimble as he once was, never so nimble in speech and in wit as in the days of his prime. From 63 to 70, who to the 10th has attained and has lived to complete it, has come to the time to depart on the ebb tide of death. A few thousand miles to the east, 200 years later, around the year 500 before the Common Era, Confucius has this pericope about age ascribed to him. The master said, at 15, I set my heart upon learning. At 30, I had planted my feet firm upon the ground. At 40, I no longer suffered from perplexities. At 50, I knew what was the mandate of heaven. At 60, I heard them with docile ear. At 70, I could follow the dictates of my own heart, for what I desired no longer overstepped the boundaries of right. I love that one. And finally, he quotes from the sayings of the fathers, the Pirkei Avot, that chapter of proverbial wisdom, which was appended, probably in the 3rd century of our era, to the Mishnah. And there the rabbis are quoted as saying, 5 is the year which the child is set to reading Torah. At 10, he is set to reading the law without commentary, the Mishnah. 13, he becomes obliged to obey the commandments of Bar Mitzvah. 15 is for Gemara study, the law and its commentaries. Shmone Esrei L'chupa, 18 for the marriage canopy, the wedding, 20 for seeking a livelihood, 30 for attaining full strength, 40 for understanding, 50 for counsel, 60 for becoming an elder, 70 for white hair, 80 for the special strength of age, 90 for being bent under the weight of the years, and 100 for being as if already dead and passed away from the world. Now, I'm struck by several things. The first, that our people, as always, lives in faith. All the other traditions end at 70. We go on to describe life to 100. But more importantly, and specific to our topic of this evening, I was struck as I saw these three paragraphs together that each of these cultures relates adultness, maturity, to settled convictions, to the time when our mind is made up, we are certain of what we feel, confident of our philosophy, confident of our faith, able to marshal our energies in a single direction. Let's look again at these three texts. Solon, 7th century Greek. Now in his 6th, that is from 35 to 42, his mind ever open to virtue broadens and never inspires him to profitless deeds. Now this is a world that believed in the search for wisdom, the love of philosophos, the love of knowledge. It believed that if you trained the body and trained the mind, you ultimately activated the mind so that the mind knew, saw beyond the world of appearances to the world of reality. And it believed that the mind, which had broken the shell of appearances and could see to the very heart of things, that mind could direct the steps aright, could lead us to live a virtuous life, and that there were no psychological impediments, a modern term. There was nothing to prevent the man who knew from living the completely virtuous life. It's this idea that lies behind Plato's philosopher king. For the philosopher king will not be corrupted by power. The philosopher king will not lead his people astray. For he knows what is needed. He knows in what the truth, the right, consists. And he will discipline himself according to that knowledge. Settled convictions, certainty, confidence, clearness of thought. Now let's look at Confucius. At 40, I no longer suffered from perplexities. At 50, I knew the mandates of heaven. The Confucian Book of Rites tells us that when a young person turned 20, they passed through a ceremony which was called capping, or quan li, a ceremony which declared that they were now adult. But the next 20 years were to be spent in study, in earning a living, in courting, establishing one's family. And it was only when one became 40 that one was properly prepared to accept the responsibilities of the scholar official, the responsibilities of power. Why? At 40, I no longer suffered from the perplexities. My mind was clear. I knew what was right. I knew what should be done. I could be trusted to impose the law, justice, the right on others. And at 50, that clarity takes on a slightly different perspective. At 50, I know what are the mandates of heaven. Now, this suggests that there are transcendental commandments, that there are laws, rules of behavior, which are in tune with, in consonance with the universe. And at 50, I sense what this relationship is, and I guide my life accordingly. And I suspect that there's another idea implicit in this concept of the mandate of heaven. At 50, I learn that I will not complete the task, that the world will still be imperfect when I've given it my best efforts, when I've tried to do all that I can do. Confucius, between 40 and 50, lived a very difficult life. Some of his closest young disciples died. He was threatened by one of the generals of Sung. His life was endangered. The Chinese emperor turned his back on his advice. His life seemed to be going nowhere, but he knew that regardless of the external circumstances, regardless of the fact that none of us achieve fully our goals, we must continue to do what we by then feel we know is right to do. It's like the old rabbinic proverb, Lo alecha hamlacha ligmor, v'lo ata ben horim lihibatel mimena. Yours not to complete the task, but neither are you free to desist from it. And the same theme is picked up again in the rabbinic text, 40 for understanding, 50 for giving counsel. At 40, we have not only absorbed the Talmud, the law, the specifics of the law, but its spirit, understanding. And at 50, we are wise enough to be trusted to with authority, to give leadership and advice, and to have some control over the lives of others. Now, these three traditions suggest that when we come, the change between youth and adulthood is a change which involves increasingly an awareness by us of what our convictions, what our principles, what our faith really is. And that somehow out of the straining, out of the struggles of adolescence, of young adulthood, when we somehow seem to be like the butterflies trying to shake itself away from the cocoon, moving in seemingly in every direction at once, we suddenly emerge and we know who we are in the sense that we know what it is that we really believe. We've tried a lot of things. We've had a lot of experiences. And somehow out of these experiences and reflecting upon them, we have come to more or less settled convictions. Now, anyone who is a clergyman, anyone who deals with convictions, with faith, with principles day in and day out, knows that there's a certain truth to this. Because religion is very different for the adolescent, for the young adult, than for the settled adult. When we organize activity for our young adults, there's a certain intensity to them. We know that they want to debate the cosmic issues. We know that they want to be, if they are in shul, they want it to be an intense experience, a shulin, all night long, to explore their spirits, to explore themselves. But when we get into our 30s and 40s and 50s, we come occasionally, we come to be reminded, we come to share a moment of fellowship with friends who share values with us, share a destiny with us. We come because it's good to leave behind the cacophony of the world and find the silence and the simple voice of faith. There's a difference of temperature in the religious activity of the adult and of the young person. When William James, one of the first of the philosophers, psychologists, who studied religious behavior at the early part of the century, began to write in the field of religious experience. He studied primarily the experience of the Pilgrims and the Puritans, the early Protestants of New England. Our Pilgrim Fathers were people who believed that one could hear the call of God. There was what was called a conversion experience, when suddenly one sensed the presence of God and one felt called, one had received the Lord, and then one could be received into the fullness of the church. And one of the things that William James noted in these studies of the conversion experience is they almost always happened to young people. It's no happenstance that Jesus was a young man when he felt his missionary call, that Muhammad was a young man when he felt the voice of God was speaking to him, the Quran, the Word of God. It's no happenstance that most of the calls which are felt by people to join a political crusade, an economic ideology, a religious faith, most of the conversion experiences occur to us sometime between 17 and 30. And one of the interesting observations of Dr. Levison in his book, one which was particularly interesting to me, is that unlike William James, who tended to say that these calls, these moments of conversion, when Joan of Arc sees the Spirit of God, when Bernadette sees the Madonna, that these moments come not only in the late teens, but they tend to come over a period of time between, say, 17 and 30, 31 and 32. And that after that age, we are settled into those things which will be our convictions, our principles, our faith, our first principles, the things by which we guide our lives for most of the rest of our adult lives. Very few adults change their fundamental principles. It's an interesting fact. Conversion takes place almost entirely among the very young, that is, those below 30, and among those who are moving from adulthood into age, when there's another moment of terrible emotional stress and strain, but primarily among the young. And if we reflect back on our own development, I think most of us will recognize that somehow during those years, we emerged into our philosophy, we emerged into our faith, we emerged into our convictions. Now, one thing that I found fascinating is the correlation between the observations of Levinson upon these first years, the years in which we move into the adult, where he calls them the transition years into adulthood, and one of the biblical novelettes, the story in which the Bible describes the young Joseph. I mean, the young Jacob. Jacob, you recall, was a twin. He was the younger twin. He was a lithe young boy. He was a very pretty young boy, very dependent upon his mother. His brother was a more athletic type, more outdoorsy, a favorite of the father. The father was determined, as he drew towards the end of his life, to give the blessing, which was the statement of primogeniture, the right of inheritance of the family name and family authority, to the older of the two twins. The mother was determined to gain that right for her favorite. And she created an elaborate ruse in which the young Jacob participates, willingly it would seem, and the ruse is successful, and Jacob receives the blessing, and then he flees. He flees from the anger of his older brother. And we get the first of these moments of trauma, of conversion, of recognition of self, of recognition that we are responsible for our lives, for that's the first recognition which antedates or is the basis of the development of principle. He flees in the first night. He's out in the wilderness. He has no cover. He's no tent. He takes a stone as his pillow, and he lies down, and he falls into a fretful sleep. And he sleeps, and he dreams. And he dreams he sees a ladder. Its base is on the ground. Its top is in the heavens. And there are angels ascending and descending the ladder. And the voice of God speaks to him. And the voice of God speaks of the covenant, of obligations and of promise. It reminds him of the larger responsibilities, the responsibilities of which we're not consciously aware when we're young people. And that somehow this covenant, this responsibility, these obligations, these duties apply to him. And when he awakens from his dream, he says to himself, "Truly, the Lord is in this place, and I knew it not." Somewhere in those early years, in those late teens, early 20s, we suddenly become aware of the fact that we're alive in the sense that we are responsible for our lives. No one else. We are alive and we are mortal. Truly God is in this place. And until now, we knew it not. But that's only the beginning of the movement, the trauma, the emotional energy which must be expended before we arrive at our principles. Jacob goes to live with one of his distant relatives, and he works for many years for him, and he falls in love with one of his daughters, as you'll recall, and he has promised the daughter in marriage if he'll work for 7 years. And then Laban tricks Jacob, and because he wants to marry off his older daughter, Leah, first, as was only appropriate, and he marries Leah, and then he must work another 7 years for his bride, the woman whom he really marries, Rachel, whom he really loves, Rachel. And having completed this period of about 14 years, 18 to 30 or 32, having matured, having come into himself, he now realizes that there must be a moment of transition into adulthood when he finally proves out his convictions. And the proof that he devises is that he can go back and face his brother and that the family can be reunited. And so he goes back to Canaan. But he hasn't heard from his brother for the full 14 years. And he worries, will he be accepted? Will his brother send out an armed band against him? And as he approaches the boundaries of Esau's land, he sends ahead a group of men with wealth, gifts, to try and placate the brother. And there's no response. Several days later, he sends more gifts, more men, and more flock ahead as another gift. And again, there's no response. And now he's come to the boundary of the land of Canaan, to the river Yabbok. And the question is, shall he cross and put his life in jeopardy? That is, shall he cross from immaturity into maturity, from irresponsibility to responsibility, from the lack of convictions to a life of convictions? Has he the guts to do it? And again, he sleeps. And again, he dreams. And this time, in his dream, he wrestles with an angel of God. And he wrestles the long night, call it wrestling with your conscience, wrestling with yourself, wrestling with your own lack of convictions becoming convictions. And neither the angel nor Jacob can pin the other. And it becomes morning. And the angel turns to Jacob and said, you have wrestled with God and with man, and you have prevailed. What shall I do for you? And Jacob says, give me a blessing. And instead of giving his blessing, he gives him a new name. He said, no longer shall you be called Jacob, you shall be called Israel, because you have wrestled with God and you have prevailed. And that's the beginning, that's the full entry into adulthood. The conversion experience is rarely that thing which we see in a Cecil B. DeMille movie. Suddenly, you know, a giant illumination behind a young person, they've seen the light and everything becomes clear. It sometimes is that. But for most of us, who are not religiously sensitive, who have not been raised in a particular mystic tradition, for most of us, there's a long period between that first moment when we recognize that we are mortal and responsible for our lives, and that final moment when we take responsibility for our lives and cross the ford and live in a way that is pleasing now to us. We have wrestled with ourselves, with our fears, with our dependencies, and we have not been overcome. And I've been struck by something else, a correlation between this longish period in which convictions emerge. And some material was presented from this platform about a year ago by Dr. James Wilson of Harvard University. He's a man who's his field is contemporary government. He's particularly been interested in criminology, crime in the United States, and the patterns of crime. And we know very little about what makes for crime, but one thing is emerging, one truth is emerging from all the statistical studies, and that is that a crime relates to age. Something on the order of half of all the crime in the United States is violent crimes committed by those who are under 20 years of age. And the most interesting thing is that very little of this kind of erratic, impulsive crime is committed after people pass 30, 32, or 34. By that time, except for the professional criminal or the paranoid, the erratic individual, most of the juvenile delinquents have become part of the straight society. They've had that moment where they've wrestled with themselves, and for better or for worse, they've accepted family, accepted responsibility, accepted certain kinds of duties. Principle has somehow entered their lives. Once we pass that age of 30 or 32, we settle down. We become people of certain principles. Not all of us live up always to those principles, but we have principles, we have convictions, we have a faith. And then a test becomes, of course, whether we live by that faith, which is ultimately the test of adulthood. What do we do with that faith? What do we do with these convictions? And what do we do with these principles? But now there's a sense of release and of relief. The period of straining, of fighting with ourselves, is over. We now can allow our energy simply to flow out. And now between 30 and 40 and 50, it's not simply that we're at the top of our form, that we've mastered a particular field, It's also that we're no longer at war with ourselves. The energies flow directly, and they flow freely in whatever direction we've allowed them, decided that they ought to flow. There's a sense of clarity, a sense of certainty to our lives which has not been there before. And adulthood is that period of settled convictions when we find ways to reinforce our convictions ritually, ceremonially, however. But the convictions are now ours. I don't know how many of you happen to read or hear today one of the leaders of the Union American Hebrew Congregations speaking on the fact that he believed that now was the time for liberal American Judaism to go out and to become a missionary movement. We were talking about this at dinner. If we become a missionary movement, any missionary movement, any movement which tries to win the hearts of people, to make converts, to help to gain people who will be convinced that theirs is the right way, must work with those who are 30 and below. That's where the converts are. It's no matter of chance that those who join the political cells, those who join a particular ideology, those who join a particular religion are almost always young people. They're the people who can be convinced because there's the need to know and to learn and to become involved with. And if a group wants to gain converts, if a group wants to draw people to itself, even if it wants only to bring the next generation up into its own ranks, it's in these years that it must concentrate. And it must provide the activities which are appropriate to those years. Young people in these years don't want to sit in pews. Pews are straight and they're confining. This is a time of action and of wrestling. You're not ready to sit quietly and to listen to somebody else. You want intensity and not the calm of an organ playing over you. You want commitment, activity, proof of conviction. You want participation in an electric group, a group which can magnetize you, catalyze, allow your energies to spill out. And it's that kind of activity that all groups who have conviction must engage in if they want to retain the loyalty of their own or attract others to their group. Now, what are some of the problems attendant to adulthood as far as convictions are concerned? We've spoken of the great profit of having settled convictions. Now our energies are free. Now we can concentrate ourselves, our emotions, our feelings, our competence on accomplishing what we set out to do. But what are the problems? The first problem is this, that no one is an island unto himself. Contrary to popular opinion, we don't arrive at faith, at our political ideologies, at our convictions in solitude. We arrive to them in a community, with groups, with friends, with those who share concerns with us. You don't suddenly find a Buddhist in the middle of a group of Jews. You don't suddenly find somebody involved in Indian politics in the middle of the United States. You pick up from the environment, from the electricity, from the concerns of those who are part of your environment, those activities, those vibrations, those interests, which somehow or other you will either accept or reject or weave into your final web of faith, web of convictions. And so we almost always arrive at our convictions at the same time that we involve ourselves, we become members of a cell, a congregation, a party, some group of people who share our principles, our loyalties, and our concerns. And that creates for us a problem. Because institutions, parties, groups, congregations have lives of their own. The young people, the older people who joined the People's Church in Indianapolis 20 years ago, when Reverend Jim Jones was speaking of brotherhood and adopting children of many races, when the church spoke of a kind of visionary socialism or communism, these people joined a church which expressed many of the finest aspirations of man. But if they stayed with that church during the long period in which the corruption of the leader ultimately corrupted the teachings of the community, they found themselves engaged in activities which they would not have dreamt of being part of at the beginning. And unfortunately, we are all creatures of habit. We're all lazy, in a sense. We tend to stay with those loyalties and those groups with which we originally affiliate without thinking of how the group itself has changed, how the anti-war movement becomes the weatherman, how some reaction to liberalism becomes fascism, how the disciples of an economic theory become disciples of Russian internationalism. Every group to which we become loyal has a life of its own. And one of the critical problems for all of us as adults is to check up from time to time on the institutions with which we are affiliated to make sure that despite the friendships we have made in those institutions, despite the sense of fraternity, of solidarity, which is so important, the sense of community, the institution still reflects the values which are ours, the values which made us join that institution in the first place. And a second problem with convictions has to do with the fact that if we're talking about serious convictions, about faith, about those things which go to the heart of life itself, we're talking about truth. And we're talking always about sharing that truth with others. There's certain kinds of convictions which are essentially trivial. You know, a stitch in time saves nine, don't waste your time, keep your nose to the grindstone, all those proverbial bits of wisdom. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about faith, a political faith, an economic faith, a religious faith, the things which propel us, our vision, our dream of the social order. Now, we all have these dreams, every one of us. And every one of us would like others to share that dream. Every conviction, in this sense, is by definition missionary. Now, we've all seen the dangers of missionary activity. We all know that Christian ministers went into Asia and went into Latin America and went into Africa, and they were, in a sense, agents of the mother country, of a colonial government, and they imposed upon the natives attitudes and values which were totally irrelevant and often dysfunctional for the tribal life, for the level of cultural development, for the particular nature of these communities. But the missionaries who went out did so in love. They went out because they were people of settled convictions, because they wanted to offer salvation to these people. Now, we in America have been fat and prosperous and powerful. And we've tended to assume that prosperity and power would, and technology would ultimately make the rest of the world become open and free and democratic. So we haven't thought very much about selling our ideas, about being missionaries, but the rest of the world has. There is no governmental activity more intensely prosecuted in our world than the missionary activity. And that activity can be simply the domestic control of the educational system and of the media propaganda. It can be the kind of gulag, the kind of re-education camp which Cambodia, Russia, China, other governments in the world have operated to re-educate the people, to modify behavior, to make certain that everyone will march in step towards the promised land. People are competing for minds, and it's almost inevitable that if we are people of conviction, we want to convince others that they should share our vision and our hope. and we're frustrated when others walk in a different direction. Because if there's going to be peace on earth and fraternity, everybody's got to link arms and walk together. So settled convictions are almost inevitably missionary in concern. And once they become missionary, they become intolerant. Because you stand in, not in my way, you stand in the way of peace, you stand in the way of economic justice, you stand in the way of the workers' freedom, whatever it may be. People of conviction are both the most blessed and the most dangerous of all human beings. And it's inevitable that we are people of convictions. And how do we resolve this dilemma? Well, I suspect it can be resolved only by the assiduous cultivation of humility. Everybody's talking now about the importance of a healthy ego. It's also very important that we have a humble ego. That we recognize that, not that everybody has the right to his own opinion, that goes almost without saying, except when that opinion stands in the way of what I know to be right. Now what happens when what you believe stands in the way of what I know to be right? It depends how big an ego I have. If my ego is large enough, I try to steamroller you. I try to convince you. And if I can't convince you, then you're a fanatic, an obscurantist, the enemy. And once you become the obscurantist and the enemy, I can devise all kinds of rationalizations which allow me to do almost anything with you. The Nazis did it to the Jews. The Russians have done it to dissidents. This kind of contempt for all those who oppose what we know to be our convictions, our truth, is endemic in our world. That's why there have been religious wars, and that's why, imagine this. In the 20th century, millions of people have died because somebody wrote a book in economic philosophy. And because that book became a faith, it became an imperial faith. It became the center of the religious war in the West of the 20th century. Now, how do we resolve this tension between being people of settled conviction and yet of necessity having to live with others whose settled convictions are opposed to our own? And here, dear friends, I suspect we have to have another conviction. The conviction that ours will never be a perfect world. If you can accept that, then you can live with other people's truth. Because then you can live with disorder. But if you're still enough of the visionary, the messianist, the child, to require the vision that everything is solved, everything is resolved, there is peace everlasting, the only way you're going to achieve that is if you can brainwash everybody to be exactly like you. Religions have found it very hard to say that anybody else has the right to go into heaven but their own communicants. And political ideologies find it very difficult to say that there's any other political system which has a right to survive, but one which agrees with their political ideology. And that's what is true of politics, and true of religion, is true of economics, and social organization, and everything else. Now, all of us have to cultivate, one way or another, both the ego strength and the humility, both the vision and the cynicism. That's which allows us to know the vision will never be completed. For us to accept what is in fact the truth, that we'll never have a world of complete peace, we'll never have a world in which everyone agrees, we'll never have a world in which there won't be bitter quarrels between people, and that our truth will never be anything more than a very tiny sliver of the whole truth. That's a very hard, hard point to accept, because faith is a redeeming set of ideas, and what redeems my life certainly ought to redeem yours. And this brings me to the final issue of conviction that I want to deal with in this prepared part of our evening, and that is the challenge that your children raise to your settled convictions. Once you're an adult, you have children. And the older we get into adulthood, the more settled our convictions become. After all, we've had more experience, we know more. Why doesn't he listen to me? My experience could help him. And here we have the generational gap. I know I have settled convictions. I have the experience to back up my convictions. They've worked for me. I'm successful. That's the proof of my convictions. And my adolescent has to reject my convictions in order to gain convictions of his own. This challenge to my convictions is inevitable. And woe betide the parent who thinks that they can missionarize, sermonize, impose upon their children what they know to be the truth. Because it can't be done. And you'll destroy your child if you succeed in brainwashing your child. And in point of fact, if we'd only recognize that we've had the child during the most formative of years, when all those basic things that need to be done for his character are done. We've loved the infant, and so freed the infant to love. We've nurtured the infant and taught him the importance of sharing, of being supportive. We've brought the infant into a whole variety of experiences and allowed him to sense, or her to sense, some of the possibilities of the world. The order of nature makes sense, in the sense that character, those things which deal with quality, with the basic emotional construct of a person, are affected, are molded, or shaped largely during the youngest of years, when the child's not in rebellion. The child is going to live a different life than ours. The faith the child needs to be different from ours, particularly in a world of future shock. Particularly when our experience may not at all be relevant in many ways to the reality that the child will have to face 10 years out, 30 years out, and long after we're dead. And unless we recognize this fact during the late teens and early 20s, or have the good sense to send our child off to college and to welcome him home only for a week or so at the time, and then to keep the conversation on his level and without imposing, you know, the papal bull upon him, only then will we really be able to welcome the child, 28, 30, or 32, into the adult world. And it's surprising, you know, over the years, how many parents have come to me and said, you know, of their grown-up young people, hey, I finally like him. He's a nice human being. There were terrible years, those years of stress, because we tried to missionarize. We try to brainwash, we try to sermonize, and it can't be done. And yet it's inevitable, I suspect, that we try. I've certainly tried. What else can you do with those things that you fundamentally believe, which are part of the core of your being? Who's more precious to you than your own children? For them not be able to share your faith, your hopes, your vision, it's a terrible, terrible trauma. And yet it's one that, as adults, we have to face. There's a final problem. It's the problem of judging which of our convictions are worth having and which are worthless. It's not enough to say I'm a person of conviction. Jim Jones had convictions. Hitler had convictions. Stalin had convictions. You have to have the right kind of convictions. And that's one of the things that a great spiritual, humanistic faith like Judaism can help you to achieve. Because it gives you certain benchmarks. If your faith involves contempt for other people, you find no confirmation of that faith in this ancestral tradition. It's good to wonder, why do I have these principles? If your principle is simply to make out and get ahead, you find no confirmation of that kind of ultimate selfishness in this tradition. If your faith involves a respect for the dignity of others and for your respect for yourself and for your own mind, for the spirit of others and for your own spirit, for justice and love, that you find confirmation of in a great religious tradition such as this one. And you can find reconfirmation, a reason to believe that your principles, your convictions may be valuable, valid. But that's the hardest task of all. How do we get perspective on our own traditions? We've seen people who have determined to deprogram youngsters caught up in one or another of the cults, and how difficult it is to make people see the folly of what is to us patently foolish. Well, what would a Martian feel if they put us under the microscope about our faiths and our convictions? Would we seem, in a sense, as foolish as some of the Moonies? How much of our conviction, how many of our basic principles really could stand up under that kind of dispassionate scrutiny? We've got to get sometimes a little bit of distance from ourselves, from our own principles. And one of the ways that a great tradition helps you in this is that it gives you great texts. It gives you a rich tradition against which you can measure what it is you believe. I think you can date the moment at which the People's Temple became an abomination. A young assistant minister of Jim Jones, when he was in Indianapolis, reported in 1961 one day, he took a Bible and he threw it on the floor in the middle of a service, complaining, "They're more interested in this than in me." Now, the fact that there's a Bible, a Talmud, a tradition, is one advantage of an ancient and noble faith. Because it says, however corrupted the preacher may be, however misbegotten I may be at the moment, I'm always brought up short by 3,000 years of a religious and ethical and spiritual tradition which has refined itself over that period of time and can be a grid for me against which I can measure myself. But that's very difficult to do. For we often have eyes, but we see not, and ears, but we hear not. And when we're most convinced, we're most liable to be blind to our own failings. And so settling down into adult age frees our energies, allows us to do more, to achieve more, but at the same time puts us in danger of using these energies for misbegotten ends. And that's why some lives, adult lives, are noble, and some are ignoble, and most of us fall someplace in between. Well, let's have some questions. Do I think that adjustment or compromise with younger ideas or mores is a surrender? Yes. Why must I compromise my principles simply because somebody who's younger than I has other principles? That's not to say that I must not be open to the fact that even young people can speak the truth. And Mikol Talmidai Hiskalti, our tradition says, from all my children, my pupils, I've learned something. But I need not, one of the least becoming things of this generation is that we tend to reverse what our fathers did, Our fathers gave exorbitant deference to age, forgetting that age is often senility, and we give exorbitant deference to youth, forgetting that youth may often be folly. And both those extremes are wrong. I think we have to listen to anybody who's talking good sense and make up our own minds. Somebody else? Yes. How old are you?
And I think this is one of the problems why there's so many divorces now, that people just don't have any convictions anymore.
Historically, most people who've ever lived have not been able to live up to their convictions, to which I add, thank God. Because I tried to define yesterday, to this congregation, what a cult was. And a cult is different, it separates itself out from a religious structure simply by intensity, by being literal about one's convictions. Now, there are two ways, obviously, of responding to what you say. First of all, I'd be out of business if everybody lived up to their convictions. That is to say, Yom Kippur wouldn't exist anymore. We are human. No man is a saint. There's no one on earth so righteous that they sin not, that they don't fail. And whether we're 20 or 40 or 60, we fail to live up to the best that's within us, clearly. And there are some who fail more, and there are some who fail less. That's to be human. But at the same time, as you live through life, you realize that you can't live simply by convictions. That is to say, if I were to live only by ultimate convictions that I ought to devote my energies and my life to the service of mankind, I'd have no chance to be with my family and to do what I need to do with my family. If I live only by a concern for others, what are the concerns that are legitimate to myself? Yes, as earthlings, we are weak, fallible, and ought to do far more than we do. But I don't think that's a factor simply of age. I really don't. I think it's a factor of personality. That is to say, I think that it depends upon the individual. And I think that in our society, where we have, to a large degree, lost a sense of a compelling vision, we have been tempted to be far more self-involved, materialist, if you will, indulgent than perhaps in other societies. At the same time, we've been able to be far more tolerant of others than if we were people of burning conviction and others disagreed with us. It goes back to what I said about, utopian thinking. I have only one ideology, and that is that no ideology is correct. I have only one messianic principle, and that is that the messianic age will never arrive. We're on a messianic journey. We do all that we can, and it's never enough. And I don't know, what to answer you beyond that, except to say that I hope that when you get to be 30 and 40 and 50, you will feel that you have done, all that you needed to do, given the buffets, the challenges, the confusions, and the convulsions of life. Ultimately, that's the judgment each of us must make on themselves. Yes?
Reverend Harvey Cox, when he was here and talked about young people turning into cults, said that he felt that possibly all religions, traditional religions, Western-oriented religions, have failed young people, and that young people have turned to cults for a certain kind of authority, and that religions haven't modernized themselves to be able to provide answers for the sense of conviction that young people need to face a very complicated world. Do you see any trend in any of the Orthodox faiths perhaps filling this gap and modernizing themselves in order to be
Well, Dr. Cox has made a good living out of the cults and suggesting that, that there is a good deal in their success, which throws a dark light on religious life. Let me suggest this to you, that it's not a question of the traditional religions modernizing themselves. We're a modern tradition. It's a question of young people not wanting, many of them, what is modern, what is reasonable, what is calm, what is liberal. One of the interesting things about faith, about this search that goes through the teens and the 20s, is this factor of intensity. The traditions which are too cool, which are precisely the modernized traditions, are repellent because of that. We tell a youngster, make up your own mind. The cults tell the child, this is what is right. We will make up your mind for you. I am the leader. I know the right. Here is the light and here is the truth. Unless you are one who believes that in the name of fighting the cults, we ought to go back to this kind of authoritarian direction, we can't take this road. We know now that, we know that observing modern life among young people, the most attractive of the religious traditions are the most orthodox, the most evangelical, the most intense, those who have answers. And I've often said that I wish I had the mental attitude of Billy Graham. I'm a good preacher, and if I could, in all good conscience, raise my hands and say, come unto me, here is the light, here are the answers, bring me your troubled souls, and I will lift up the burdens from upon them, and I will give the grace of God to you. I could fill these pews, because that's what, not young people, that's what you want to hear when all is said and done. But I can't do it in good conscience. And the modern liberal religious structures cannot do it in good conscience. Because we've emerged from the medieval world. We know what authoritarianism, we know the dangers of following the leader, Jonestown. That's why we have modern religions. And those who tell us, see what the young people are attracted to and make yourselves over in that image, are telling us to abandon one of the things which we believe will make progress, development, growth possible. Now, we may be on the wrong track in terms of numbers, but I don't know that we can be on any other track. That's not to say that we program all that we should do, or, all of this, but as a basic philosophic stance, I really don't think that we can take any other. How do we go one step further? How do we develop a world in which young people, those under 30, it's not a pejorative, I've tried to say to you simply the fact of age, how that they will be attracted to this kind of cool, reasonable, a tradition, liberal tradition. I don't know. We've opted for a world of change, cold technological world. It's a world which requires a great deal of time, effort, competition, drive, success. We've put them into the pressure cooker. Most importantly, we've created a society which requires that they remain children until they're in their 20s. Long periods of education, long periods will keep them, you know, away from us, with their peers, developing their imaginations, developing distance from the adult world. If the world were ever settled down, I could guarantee you that the liberal traditions would be more attractive, the mainline traditions. Until it does, I think all we can do is hope that there's enough stability in the homes, that the children were loved enough when they were young, and to recognize, I guess, this is that the problem of the appeal of the cults is the problem of the coldness, the distance of the home and of the school and of all those kinds of institutions. If a child feels secure, statistically true, he's less likely, or she's less likely, to be attracted to one of the cults than if they're tense and insecure and come from a turbulent, you know, home environment or neighborhood environment. So a whole lot of things have to be done. I don't think it's simply a question of making ourselves over into the image of the Maharishi or the Divine Light or any of these other groups. I really don't. You feel that compared to Solon and Confucius, the sayings of this one saying of the rabbi falls short. It's not that so much. It's simply like most things Jewish, a little more practical. You know, it's really a school curriculum. It's a, I suspect there's a bit of attempted rabbinic humor in here. It's much more brief and much less descriptive of the stages, but it's still revealing in that respect. This doesn't, you know, begin to exhaust what the rabbi said about adulthood, believe me. It was simply one that Dr. Levinson picked out and put side by side, and therefore I used it. What did Judaism say about adulthood, traditional Judaism? It said, first of all, adulthood must be marked by learning. It was a long lifetime argument against ignorance, against assuming that you knew the right simply because you knew it. You had to think problems through and study. It said something about family responsibility. Interestingly, it's the only one of these traditions in which marriage is, you know, an obligation early on in life, as opposed to in your 30s when it's an obligation because you want an immortality, as opposed to a sense of family. It's the rabbinic tradition on adulthood is one of growing responsibility, emphasis on experience. It's one in which there was very great concern about uncertainty and doubt. You weren't supposed to study philosophy till you reached 39, and you were wise enough not to be disturbed by the questions it might raise. It's primitive in the sense that it's early. All of these traditions are early. After all, we started by saying this whole series that the study of adulthood is a study of the last 10 years. It's really only in that period of time that people have begun to study this whole phenomenon that we've been talking. We've lived it, we've assumed it, we've assumed its rightness, we've assumed that adults were the acme of it all. But now we're beginning to study who we are and what we are. I do. I can't, it'd be pointless to tell them anything else. They're going to do it anyway. That's the whole point. You are casting them adrift. That's the beginning of maturity. Yes, you have to cast your child adrift. And the sooner the better, once they've reached late adolescence, early 20s. I was suspected of the parenting problems that come into my office. The largest part of them are problems which involve smothering love. That is, love which was good and valid at 6, which is still being practiced in the same way at 16 or at 26. And I'm not arguing that, you know, you ought to do what some swimming teachers do, that they take the child and just throw the child into the water and say, now swim. Obviously, there have to be ties. And it's important to help a child understand how you can be part of a family and yet yourself. But there has to be a long period of walking away. That's why we take it for granted. One of the strengths of our conventional wisdom is the child should go away to school. You know? And probably the child should stay away vocationally. However much we may want them to come back into a family business or something of that kind for a few more years. Because that period of apartness is the formative period of the child's adult personality, their faith, their philosophy, their convictions. Now, each of us lives with a partner in marriage whose convictions are not identical with ours. We don't need to, our love isn't less because we vote different political tickets, or because we have very sharp differences of economic philosophy or anything else. We can love and respect and admire that person despite those differences. And the same thing is true between parents and children. We don't have to have that absolute identity of principle. But what we can't have is that kind of intense dependence which the child always resents and the parent cannot always manage, which always leads to a disastrous explosion. It really does. And as far, a child has to be weaned twice. Once from the breast and once from the nest. Before we close and before Bob comes up here, I want to say just one thing. I want to thank the Mr. and Mrs. Club of the Temple, Bob and Beverly Kendis, their president, for organizing this third annual coping series for us. We've had remarkable response from you. I hope you found these programs to be as interesting as I have. And if all goes well and the Temple can afford it, we'll have another coping series next year. Bob.
Thank you, Rabbi, for a very thought-provoking and inspiring discussion. It really was a very perfect way of ending our problem with coping with adulthood. Adulthood is the least talked about and the least studied period of living. In an attempt to shed some light upon the problems of being an adult, the Temple has sponsored these 6 lectures. And the Mr. and Mrs. Club, on behalf of the Temple, certainly hope you really enjoyed it. I would like to take this opportunity to thank the members of the committee, Dr. Aaron Billowitz, Paula Block, Bart Buchatz, Dr. Daniel Deutschman, Bob and Linda Sanders, Leslie Levin, and perhaps most especially my wife, Bev, who has spent every night of the 6 nights planning and developing and organizing each and every one of the refreshments that we have had this evening, as well as each and every one of the lectures. And I really think that she deserves a special thanks. In addition to that, least we not forget Rabbi Klein for his advice and guidance in helping us with the series. And finally to Claire Shaw, Mary Tepper, and Bubbles Whitman, who without their special guidance in those special areas, we would not have been able to do any of the things that we have done. I wish to thank them especially, and the hostesses and hosts that have helped us pour coffee and pass out the refreshments. Now, if you would like, I'll join in the social hall for a little more coffee and refreshments. Thank you.